So we're doing something, this series, Restoring Patterns of Renewal, and it's a four-part series. We're in week three at the moment, and so the last couple, I just want to recap on those as we get going. Week one, Pete looked at the what of discipleship. What is it? What is it? And he looked at sort of the New Testament model and looked at the whole idea that discipleship is apprenticeship. Apprenticing ourselves to Jesus. That looks like three things: being with him, becoming like him, and doing the stuff he did. Being with him, becoming like him, and doing the stuff that he did. That's what the New Testament model of discipleship is. And then, because right at the heart of all of that is this idea of transformation. Transformation from stuff to stuff. From not being with him to being with him. From not being anything like him to being like him. From not doing the stuff that he did to doing the stuff that he did. Transformation, change, is right at the heart of the New Testament model of discipleship. So we ask the question, well, how do we change? How do we change? Because it feels like so often we live an experience of frustration rather than transformation. And so we sort of tried to do a bit of re-understanding. How is it that we changed? And we looked at this here, that the patterns of our life, the habits, the stuff that we're surrounded by, the attitudes, the dominant stories, the narratives that we're surrounded by, the images, et cetera, they all place in us deep longings. Loves that we are chasing afterwards, because these patterns, they form desires, and these desires, they get a hold of us at our deepest level, and they aim us. We start to move towards the thing that we started to love. And so the heads up with all of that is that that misdirected loves lead to misdirected lives. If we start to love the wrong stuff, it's not long before our life follows. We start to move in the direction of it. And so James Smith, who's one of the thinkers around this stuff, suggests that discipleship is to curate your heart, to be attentive to and intentional about the things that you love. It's this whole idea of like, let's wake up. Let's wake up to the patterns that we're surrounded by, that are forming desires and that are aiming us. Let's wake up to them, and then let's get intentional about discipling one another in life-giving patterns and rightly ordered desires. So that's sort of week two. So we've done the what is discipleship. We've done something about the how. And this week is about the where. Where are we trying to be these kinds of disciples? Where are we doing it? Nobody has ever followed Jesus in a vacuum. In a neutral space. There's always been a context, and context and environments, they're important, because they create certain challenges, they create certain opportunities, they make us like this or like that. And so the environment is really, really important. And obviously our environment today is the city. It's London. That is the place that we're trying to follow Jesus in. And so we want to pay attention to it. What is our environment like? Because we're aware that it has its own challenges and opportunities. And so tonight we're wanting to look at that. And I don't know how you feel about the fact that you live in London, if you do indeed live in London. Like the fact that you, like, do you feel like it's happened to you by accident? The fact that you've like found yourself here? Is it something that always hoped for and longed for and aiming for? Are you one of those people sat here tonight and you feel totally full of vision, you're excited, you've got energy for this place that is London? Or are you sat here tonight thinking, gosh, I'm so tired, I'm exhausted by this city, I'm drained by it, I've got no vision for being here? I kind of feel like there's some people who cannot imagine living anywhere else. Like, this is the place that they want to be. They cannot imagine living anywhere else. And then I think there's another camp of people who cannot stop imagining living somewhere else, right? And they're on the tube and the Dominican Republic thing goes past. And it's like, oh, take me there now. Like, let's go. Because it's tough here. And I've been in both of those camps at times. I remember when it first came to London about 6.5 years ago, came to work in politics, in parliament, and I remember getting my suit on that first day and getting suited and booted up and getting the tube in, it full of excitement, and you come out of Westminster and you come up the stairs and there's Big Ben right in front of you in all of its glory. And it's like, oh, wow, why would I want to be anywhere else? Like, I love this. And you walk around the corner, you go into this bomb-proof building, and you just, like, everyone's queuing up, getting their bags searched. You just, like, swipe yourself in with this new thing that you've got, and you feel like $1 million. Really, really excited about being here. But then there's been other times, and if I'm honest, the majority of my experience of London has been the other camp, which is where I found it hard to be here, tough to be here. And in some ways, that was just really practical. I've talked about this before here at KSE, but early on in our story in London, we got into loads of debt. We got into thousands of pounds worth of debt, and it hung around us for a few years. And it was just deeply, deeply difficult. And this excitement that was at the start just soon dissipated and disappeared. And all we felt was the pressure of the city bearing down on us. So much so, struggled with a lot of anxiety, trying to difficult to get on tubes. When we would drive back in from Devon, and we'd drive in over the Hammersmith flyover, I'd just have a panic attack. It's like, I love the people, I love my church here, but there's something about this place, the environment, that I just found tough. And that carried on and went on. That was a sort of really practical stuff, but it was also the subtle stuff. And I just started to become somebody I wasn't that excited about being and started to change in ways that I didn't really like. And like a trivial example, but when I first came to London and I got into Victoria Station and saw like people just flying past you, like barging old women out the way just to get to the Oyster terminal first, to get themselves in, like I was like, I'm never going to be like that. I am not going to be that person. And I was like, I'm going to walk no faster than this. This is how I'm going to walk to my workplace. I'm not going to run for tubes because they're every 2 minutes. Why would you actually run for the tube and risk getting your head stuck? Why would you do that? And I was like, I'm never going to become like that. I'm never going to be like that. 3 months, 4 months, 5 months in, and it's crept up on me, and suddenly I'm picking up the pace. I'm starting to become. And that's a trivial example, but I'd noticed, for example, like I'd become quite driven. All task focus, all those different things. I started to become things that I personally had never really wanted to become. And this all came to a head. We were, my wife and I, Anna, we were down in St. Ives last April, and we were sitting on the beach with our son, and it was like the first time that he'd been properly playing on the beach, and growing up in the Southwest, like, I thought he'd be doing that all the time. And there was this sense, and it just hit me like a train. I was like, oh, like, I don't actually know if I can go back. I don't actually know if I can go back to that city and go back over that flyover. I really found it tough. Obviously, I had to come back, so we drove back. I think it was literally the next day. Drove back, and I just started working at KXE, and I went to see Pete. He was a lot more pastoral than this is going to sound. Okay, so I don't want to like make him out to be. He's a great, great person to work for. But I went into his office and just said, like, oh, this is where I'm at. This is what I'm struggling with. This is how I'm finding it. And he just looked me in the eyes. He said, like, Pete, that's because you've been doing London badly. You've been doing London badly. Like, I've not heard you talk about or do any thinking around, like, how can you thrive in this place? How is it affecting you? And how can I go about creating rhythms and patterns and disciplines that are going to make me thrive in this place? I'd spent 4 years essentially just consuming, just having London done to me, being on the back foot, and it had made me into someone I wasn't that excited about. I was struggling with things that I wasn't excited to be struggling with. And Peter said, like, it was basically just the kick up the bum that I needed. I needed it. And you know, it set about this process of thinking, okay, well, look, I don't want to be that guy anymore. I don't want to be the guy who's just in London but resenting it the entire time. The flat's too small. Oh, what school is Arlo going to go to when he grows up, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I just was this resentful person of being here. I want to be someone who's here, even if it's not my natural environment, even if it's not where I'd necessarily choose. I want to be here full of vision. I want to live purposefully in this place. I want to live well in this place. I want to follow Jesus as passionate as I possibly can in this place. I don't want to be on the back foot anymore going forward. And it's set about this process over a few months of trying to, of asking God to give me vision for this place. And thankfully, he has. And I can just encourage you, like, whatever camp you're in, maybe you've lived here your whole life and you'd never live anywhere else and you're really excited. Or maybe you're like me and you're not from here but you find it difficult being here. Can I just encourage you, like, that we cannot afford to be on the back foot when it comes to living in London. We cannot afford to be the people who sit back and let it just happen to us. And that is because London is like a formation machine, right? It forms us. I talked last week about how if we just wake up tomorrow on Monday and just go into work or go to wherever you whatever you do on a Monday, and nothing dramatic happens, nothing particularly bad happens or whatever, you just live your ordinary life, well, you will be shaped. You will be formed. You will be discipled. And the question is simply, like, into whose likeness or towards what kingdom? you are going to be shaped. We cannot afford to be doing what I did for the first 4 years, just letting it happen and being unaware of how I was being formed. We've got to be on the front foot. And John Tyson talks about a city like this, that it's a heavily contested space. A heavily contested space. Ideas buzzing about. People buzzing about. You're sharing everything down to the last nook or cranny of the tube, right? It's contested ambitions, cultures, religions, worldviews, etc., etc. It's a highly contested space. And then John Mark Comer, another pastor in the States, has done some more thinking around, like, what is it that's so powerful? Why is it that this is such a formation machine, the city? And he talks about these sort of this triangle of influences. And this, the thing of these things, stories, habits, and relationships. So the stories we believe from the city, the habits, that those little daily habits that we start to live out, the relationships we have, the people we're surrounded by, well, they all lead to formation. And the vast majority of us, if you anything like my first 4 years, is it's unintentional spiritual formation. We are becoming stuff unaware of doing so. And so I just want to touch on these three things, on stories, habits, and relationships as we go forward, because these are powerfully forming us as we go about our daily life. Stories. What are stories? Stories are like the dominant narratives in a city, right? They're like the dominant images. That you can tell what a place's story is by things it celebrates. So look for what your workplace celebrates, what it holds up as a good, as an ideal. That's a window into a story. And I just want to say that stories, well, they form identity by attributing worth. So they start to say what is worthwhile, what is valuable, what should be celebrated, what should be chased after. And as they do that, and as you start to live into that, then they start to form your identity around those values. The stories start to form identity by attributing worth. Let me give you an example of this from the Bible. In Ephesus, so we have Paul's letter to the Ephesians. That's Ephesus. That's the city. It was a really important city on the sort of eastern trading routes and all of that. And it had been taken over by two different empires, the Greeks first and then the Romans, where we pick up the story. And the Greeks had taken it over, and in doing so had brought this incredibly strong narrative to the city. And brought this strong storyline that would thread through it. And that's one of image. Image. So the Greeks had this total obsession with image, this chasing of bodily perfection. And what would happen is this got so ingrained, there was such strong ideals of what we should look like, that it became one of the dominant narratives of Ephesus. And what some signs of this, some of the outworkings of this, there was fairly harmless or whatever, but there was this sense of having like this type of Olympics. And they would have, and the whole city would come and watch this stuff. And the gladiators, the people performing, the athletes, they were held up as like almost like godlike figures. This is what we need to look like. And so much so that the Olympics were done naked. Just to like have everything on display, just to show like this is what we're chasing after. This is perfection. This is what we value here. And everyone watching would have to measure themselves against that ideal. And then on a real dark side of the city, there was anyone who didn't match up essentially was considered worthless. And people with disabilities horrifically were placed into circuses. And people would go and watch them and laugh. People had become entertainment because they didn't match up to the story of the city, the values of the city, what was celebrated in that city. And just as bad, it was this sense with parents. So they actually wrote down, like, what were the things that you needed to look like to be the ideal. And parents, when they had kids, had permission. When the child was born, if it didn't match up to certain elements, then they could take the baby. There was a hillside set aside outside the city, and they could take the baby there and leave them there. Expose them to the elements, expose them to wild animals. It was called the baby dump, and they would leave the baby there to die. That is how strong the narrative was playing out. That's how strong the story was in Ephesus. And this sort of trajectory here, this sense that it was an image-centric society, right? Image-centric city, but the story was like we should be chasing perfection. And then what happens is, what I talk about in terms of the critical gaze of the city, can you imagine being someone who doesn't match up to those ideals that they are pitching for, that they're shooting for? Can you imagine walking through Ephesus, through that high street equivalent in Ephesus and the people watching you. If you had a disability or whatever it might be like, imagine the critical gaze of the city. And what we then do is we internalize it. And a guy called Michael Rizzeno is a pastor in New York again, and he talks about how when we internalize a critical gaze, we feel shame. When we internalize a critical gaze, we feel shame. So imagine just on a normal level, like if someone said to you, really, you did that when you were younger? You did that. And you internalize that. You say, wow, I did. Wow, and I feel real shame about that now. That's an example of what it means to internalize a critical gaze. So when the city of Ephesus is looking at you and you're not matching up to ideals, you start to judge yourself by those values, by those goals, by those ideals. And as I said, it shapes your identity by attributing worth, right? So you feel worthless. I'm not worth anything. I'm not valuable. And you get a wrong identity. I'm not loved. I'm not lovable. I'm not worth anything in this place. I've got to strive for it, et cetera, et cetera. That's just an example in the Bible of a trajectory of a story and how it impacts some people. And I want to talk about London. And look, this is going to be much less dramatic than that one. And of course, I'm not comparing the two together. I want to talk about work just really briefly. And just as a heads up, like, I am not being a downer on work here, just as a caveat. Like, I believe work is a gift from God. I think it's an incredible thing. I think it's part of what it means to be human is to use our hands to work. I'm for hard work, actually, and I'm also for being competent in the stuff that we do. I think it's good to honor places to be around. So I just wanted to get that out there as a caveat before I talk about this. But we have to say that London is a work-centric city, right? A work-obsessed city. Think of how many of our conversations are orientated around work, what it is that we do. Think how many advertising hoards are devoted to this. How many websites to headhunting to the LinkedIn pop-ups on your phone the whole time. Like, all of this stuff, like, it is work-centric. It is work-focused as a city. And something that Marina, who's part of the church here, put in her anthology entry. She talked about how, in some ways, we become human doings, not human beings. We've, like, tied our identity so much to the things that we do. And sort of, okay, that's sort of neutral at this moment, but then if you bring in a storyline that can distort what is an incredible thing and make it an idol, and I want to talk, like, you could use the word success here, but that it's not just that we should be working, but we need to be successful in our workplace. We need to be moving forward and upward, like progressing onto the next thing, promotions. We need to be people who are proving ourselves in our workplace, improving ourselves, always climbing, always looking to the next thing, not satisfied with the current thing that you're doing. The city trades on dissatisfaction in that sense. And it kind of like moves us on, and we feel this pressure. And we start to judge ourselves according to this gaze. So what I mean by the critical gaze of the city in this sense, it's the sum total of the conversations that you have around dinner tables and in bars. It's the sum total of riding the tube and seeing the adverts constantly telling you that you could be improving, you could be doing better, you could be rising up, you should be rising up, you should be chasing this, that, and the other. And there's just this sense in all of that that then you start to judge yourself by whether or not you're impressive, whether or not you're achieving. And the thing is, like, idols always break the hearts of their worshippers. They always break the hearts of their worshippers. If we start to judge ourselves by this storyline, we start to feel worthless. We start to feel valueless. And we move our identity away from what it is in Christ to the dominant storyline of the city. If that makes sense. That's just one storyline. That's just one possible option. What would, if you were to go away from here and think about what are the stuff that you started, what are the stories you started to buy into? It'd be really interesting to start mapping those out. Start thinking about, well, what is the stuff that I've sort of bought into? Because this is just one example. So that's one little corner of the triangle that John Mark Comer was talking about. The second little corner is patterns. I talked about this quite a lot last week, so I'm not going to go into loads of depth. Do listen to last week's if you want to look at that a bit more. But just as a recap, like, everyday habits, this is what we're talking about. Everyday habits that shape our desires and our direction. The reason I put everyday in there, because they're meant to be like, they're small things. They're the small patterns of the city that we engage in that we're not even really aware of. If they were massive, if they were blatant, if they were obvious at the start, then we'd say no to them, right? But they're subtle and they sneak in, and we start to take them on board. They start to shape the things we love and therefore our direction. I love this from Ruth Valerio. She's an environmentalist and a kind of thinker and activist. And she says this: do we know how we have ended up living how we are living and why? Too often we find ourselves on the treadmill of life paying the consequences for choices we hardly knew we were making. Paying consequences for choices we hardly knew we were making. This is how the habits of the city work. They subtly sneak in, and suddenly find myself 4 years down the line sitting on a beach in St. Ives thinking, how did I get here? They sneak up on us. They shape our desires. They shape our direction and lead us to places that we hardly even knew we were going. And I just want to really briefly just say, like, I think we talked before, right, about the apprenticeship idea, that it's being with Jesus, becoming like him, and then doing the stuff that he did. And there's a reason for the order of that. Like, it all begins with being with Jesus. It all begins there. Jesus starts by saying, come, follow me. Come, be with me. It all begins with being with him. And I would say that for me, when I look back at those, certainly those first 4 years, it was like the patterns of this city, the sort of daily rituals that I got into, the daily routines, the way I used my money, et cetera, et cetera. I think one of the things they're most incompatible with was this being with Jesus bit. That they kind of like cut me off from the source. I got busied out of familiarity with his voice, busied out of intimacy with him and the Holy Spirit. And I feel like my life started to look like this one on the left. That like I was just going in so many different directions, right? I was just going surface deep with my family, surface deep with my friends, surface deep in my prayer life, et cetera, et cetera. I got busied out of depth. Busied out of being with Jesus as the source of all of this. And I guess what I'm trying to pursue now is a little bit more like the one on the right, where I can develop patterns and habits of depth in my life. Ones that lead me primarily and firstly to be with Jesus, that I might then become like him and do the stuff that he does. So that's patterns. We've had a bit of story, a bit of pattern, and then this is the idea of people, the people we're surrounded by. Now, this is going to sound like an uber obvious statement, but there are more people like you in this city and more people unlike you than ever before. There are more people like you and more people unlike you than ever before. What I mean by that is, in terms of the more people like you, I'm talking about similarity, people with the same passion, same skill set. People who occupy almost the same thing as you, the same ambition as you in life. And the challenge of that similarity is comparison, right? The challenge of similarity is comparison. So imagine, there's so many examples you could use for this, but you grow up and you're a singer-songwriter and you're gigging in your local area and you're kind of a big deal, you've got a bit of a cult following, and then you come to London and you want to make it and you get off the tube and the busker is better than you. Right? There's just so many people who can contest for the same space in this city, and they do it better than you, is how it always, and you start to compare yourself. Or a sports person comes to the city and you were like the big name in the team, and you come here, you can't make the C team. I remember coming to London to work in politics, and like I thought I'd done all right to get that. I thought I'd done well. Like, not many people have been doing that in my friendship circles. You come here and suddenly, like, where I thought I may be verging on impressive, I started to get here and it's like, oh gosh. Like, I'm the lowest of the low. And there are people here who in my office who are doing this, and they're doing it better than me. I start to compare myself. And, you go to the pub after work or whatever, and they sort of ask, like, oh, you know, what have you done this week? Have you done anything? And I'm like, well, yeah, I wrote this little piece for the Newham Recorder. It's the local paper. And I was really proud of it. It was really, really good. And like, oh, that's cool. That's really cool. Yeah, actually, a piece I did, it got picked up, Observer and The Guardian this last week, and it's kind of like quite, you know, it's actually been quite big sort of national news this year. It's like, oh, okay, really cool. And there's a bit of speech writing that goes on, so you're like, oh, have you written anything? Have you done any speech writing? Everyone wants to be the speech writer. Everyone wants to be Sam Seaborn from West Wing. And you, no. No, I didn't get enough reaction. Nobody seen West Wing? I can't actually believe that. Wow. Okay. Anyway, so, and it's like, oh, have you written anything? I was like, well, yeah, I've actually wrote this little piece for this 50th anniversary of a little local Indian cricket club, and I made a great Sachin Tendulkar joke, and it like went down really, really well. And then they're like, oh, well, I wrote like a half hour speech for the chamber, the House of Commons chamber, and it was like national news. It came up on the Sky News and everything like that. And essentially just a lot of willy waving goes on. And it's this sense that, sorry if that is offensive to anyone, but this sense that people occupying the same space, people writing better songs than you, people better at their job than you, people rising up the ladder quicker than you, and all you end up doing is comparing yourself and losing out every single time. Challenge of similarity is comparison, the discomfort of difference, i.e. those unlike you. So you're now surrounded, certainly someone coming from Exeter, like you come to London, I'm just surrounded by so much difference now. So like it's like people's different dreams, worldviews. Et cetera. And what this is all about options. Suddenly you move into this big wide world, and there's options everywhere. Careers you'd never even thought could exist. You know, and you thought, when I was growing up, I was like, oh, this is what I'm going to do, this is what I'm going to do. And then you come here, and it's like this big wide world, and you're like, wow, I could do anything. Wow, someone thinks like that. Someone's chasing after something completely different from me. Like, wow, and you start to get confused. It's sort of like you're being blown about by this. It's like, wow, you're almost paralyzed by these amount of options that you've got in front of you. The discomfort of difference is confusion or questioning. And the thing is with all of this, like, it's both challenging and it's also an opportunity. And so part of all of that, that's meant to be tectonic plates coming together and creating a mountain of culture. That's just to interpret my diagram. And it's this whole idea that, like, stories start to clash with one another and habits of the city and ways of living start to do that. And then people comparing one another and improving and opening themselves up to new ideas and new avenues. And what this does is it creates culture. It creates culture. Stuff starts to rise up. Tim Keller calls cities culture wombs. Culture is bred in these places. And so new culture starts to rise up. And the thing is, if we're on the back foot, if we're not people living intentionally in London, then the danger, the risk at least, is that you just get swept up with the culture. Not contributing to it, but just getting swept up in it. And I want to say that, so there's a huge challenge to being in London, right? It's a huge challenge to it, but I also want to say, like, it's a huge opportunity. It's hugely exciting being in this place. And so it's both challenge and opportunity. That diagram, that culture-forming diagram, I want to say that, like, we get to play in it. As Christians, we get to play. We get to contribute to that equation. We get to be in the mix there. And so what if we start to bring not just the dominant story of the city around us, but what if we start to bring the story of Jesus to the mix? And the way that he sees us. What if we start to bring that to the mix? So rewind to Ephesus. Remember that whole narrative and that storyline. That you're not worth anything. You're valueless if you don't meet up to these certain unachievable bodily perfection. Anything below that and you're not worth anything. But in Ephesians, Paul writes them and says, that's absolute rubbish. That's absolute rubbish. This is how Christ on the cross died for you and he loves you. And this is what he did for you. He made you holy and blameless and spotless in his sight. Imagine reading that after growing up in that culture where you felt worthless so much of the time. Imagine reading in Ephesians that. He sees you as homely, blameless, and spotless in his sight. Beautiful in his sight. It's a new story. It's bringing a new story into the mix. And we read later on in that same verse that he adopts us to sonship. Adopts us into his family, not cast aside on a heap on the edge of the city, but brought right into the heart of his family. That is what Christ has done on the cross. That's the story of Jesus. What if we bring that to the mix? We read in the history books that the church in Ephesus, then picking up on this theme in Paul's writing, starts to go to the same hillside on the edge of the city to go and pick up the kids that have been cast aside and adopt them into their family. A new story starts to create new culture in that city. Then what if we start to say, okay, well, I'm going to wake up to the patterns, the habits of this city. I'm going to live out patterns of life, of heaven. I'm going to paint them everywhere I go. I'm going to choose not just to be so work obsessed that I never rest. I'm going to show patterns of rest and how it leads to life. Patterns of prayer, patterns, whatever it might look like, justice, compassion, painting patterns of heaven wherever we go. What if you throw that into the mix? A new way of living. A new way of being in this place. Then We talked in that first diagram, right? Those triangles that right in the middle is the environment. And I talked about how in those first 4 years, I let the environment dominate me. I let it just wash over me and affect me. Well, what if we made the Holy Spirit our dominant environment, our dominant teacher? As people who follow Jesus, we follow him in the power of the Holy Spirit. What if daily, as part of these patterns of heaven, we become spirit-filled people, filled with the authority and power, the same power that raised Christ from the dead? What if we go into the mix with that? And suddenly you bring the story of Jesus together, the patterns of heaven together, this radical way of living differently, and spirit-filled people full of power and authority. What I really genuinely believe will start to create kingdom culture. The same equation that was quite challenging that we could just get swept up in becomes an opportunity. It becomes exciting. We get to be in the mix. We get to create culture. It's one of the amazing things about this city. Culture's going to get made. Let's be involved in the mix. Let's orientate it towards God. There's two options, consume or create. Consume or create. And we as humans, we as followers of Jesus, have always been set aside to create. Always been set aside to create. Think back to Genesis. There's this whole idea of the cultural mandate. That in Eden, God's absolute privilege of humanity was given to us to say, hey, work with me, co-work with me. See this stuff that's around us. Well, take what is here and start to extend it to the whole earth. Start to form it into life and into blessing and extend it to the whole earth. That's the cultural mandate. That's what's on human beings, made in the image of God, to be people who create. And John Tyson has this great language around this, that to be that kind of a church in this city, that a church that creates culture, we need to be a creative minority. We're kidding ourselves if we think that we're the majority, full of power to just influence. No, we're a creative minority. And some of the key markers of being like that would be that we're a strong community together. Like, you're going to need to be a strong community if we're going to be a minority that creates. So we've talked about that quite a bit the last couple of weeks. What kind of a community are we going to be here at KXC? We want to be the kind of community that's for each other, cheering each other on, rooting for one another, side by side, standing one another, contending for one another in life. If we want to be a strong community, we also want to be confident in our story. We need to know it. We need to know it and live out our story confidently, throwing it into the mix. Then there's this idea of living courageous patterns of life, patterns that may very well be different from those around you, but doing so courageously, doing so filled with the Spirit, with the power and authority of God. Karl Barth says this, a theologian from the middle of last century. He says, the church exists to set up in the world a new sign, which is radically dissimilar to the world's own manner, but which contradicts it in a way that is full of promise. Full of promise. Full of hope. When I was working in Parliament, like, Christians were famous for being like the most hatey. Like, the letters that would come from them would be the most critical. They'd be the most shouty. And you'd go from office to office and they'd be like, did you get the one from the Christian lot again this week? Because it's like worse. And it was really embarrassing. Honestly, it was right embarrassing. Going from office to office and hearing how the Christians were sending in the worst letters. Just standing back and withdrawing and just shouting at culture. Don't be like that. Don't be like that. Don't be like that. And what this is saying, what Bart is saying here is like, no, and what the creative minority thing is all about, what all of this is about, participating, but doing so redemptively. Redemptive participation in culture. Be in it, but not of it. Be in it, but bring life. Tell a new story. Show new patterns. Be filled with the Spirit. So we don't want to be the shouty lot who just disengage and just critique. We want to be people who are full of promise, but we also don't want to be people who never contradict, right? We want to be people who contradict some of the stuff that's going on in society. It'd be a shame if we gave up our distinctiveness for relevance, for the pursuit of popularity, out of fear maybe. If we lose all kinds of distinctiveness, because you know that verse that says, always be prepared to give an answer for the hope that you have, right? Always be prepared to give an answer. Well, the difficulty is that we've got an answer and we can be very well rehearsed in our answer. So let's do that and make sure we are. But if we never contradict, if we never live distinctively, then will the question ever come? Let's not be people who only have an answer. Let's be people who live lives that generate the question. Why are you like that? Let's contradict culture in a way that is full of promise, full of hope, that generates the question. A great example of this in the Bible, when we're landing here, is about Daniel and his friends, right? So there's a book in the Old Testament about Daniel, and he's got these three friends, and they live in Jerusalem, and then the Babylonians, this powerful rulers, come, and they siege Jerusalem, and they take the Hebrews, Daniel and his friends, out back over to Babylon. And they live in exile. And Daniel and his friends, they're like made to, they were from the royal household in Israel, so then they got privileged and were asked to live in the royal household in Babylon, and doing so meant they went on this almost like this course, like training them in the culture, training them in the worldview, training them in how to eat and all this different stuff. And they were trying to assimilate them, trying to make them like them so they would lose their Jewish identity. They'd let go of their God. That's how the Babylonians worked. But the thing is that they refused to do that, right? They refused to give up on their Jewish identity. They clung to their God and their story. And so they refused to do certain, they wouldn't eat certain things. And when they were all banned from praying, well, they didn't stop praying, et cetera, et cetera. And this really interesting thing happens, which is that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, has this dream, and it terrifies him. And this is the most powerful man in the world at the time. He has this dream. He goes to all of the wise people in Babylon. And all those people who are like down with their culture, who know it inside out, who are on song in terms of their culture. And he goes in and says, can you interpret this? And none of them can. None of them have the insight to do it. But and so he's looking for an answer. He goes to Daniel. He's like, you seem to live differently. You seem to have wisdom. Like, can you help? Can you help? And of course, Daniel does interpret the dream. It's this sense that despite living in the culture, he'd maintained his distinctiveness. And that's the thing, that Daniel's distinctiveness was his relevance. See, if he just assimilated, if he just become like the Babylonians, when that moment came, when society was asking questions, when it was hurting, he wouldn't have had an answer, because he would have become just like everyone else. If we lose our distinctiveness, we lose our voice. We lose our way in. Daniel's distinctiveness and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who refused to not pray and so thrown into the fiery furnace. And then the king comes on board and starts the worship of God. Like, they lived with distinctiveness in that culture. They got to shape it back. They got to shape it back. Plato says this amazing thing, like, can we set aside just for a moment the fact that Plato had a totally different view of heaven to us? Just leave that. You've heard that one in Plato's thought. Everything to do with Plato, nothing to do with the New Testament. Anyway, Plato had a different view, but it's got very, very nice language, and it's a beautiful language. He's writing in this Republic thing. He says that Athens, this city that he's in, will only ever flourish. This city will only ever be fully alive when it is designed by artists who imitate heavenly pattern. Designed by artists who imitate heavenly pattern. I just want to say to you today, I want to encourage you that you are those artists. That you. You are the people full of the Holy Spirit who've been given a mandate to create. You are those artists. And when we live out heavenly patterns, when we live out and we follow Jesus with everything that we've got, we get to redesign. We get to play in culture creation. We get to redesign. What does your workplace look like? What does your student union look like? What does that culture of parenting look like? Whatever it is, whatever is your dominant culture that you're in, whatever you spend your time, like, if you are those artists, let's imitate Heavenly Pattern. Let's follow Him wherever we go. I really believe that we will then be people who get to redesign the places that we are, with an imagination of the kingdom. And suddenly this city, which is incredibly challenging, becomes incredibly exciting.